Good morning. What a fascinating book you've chosen this time, huh? Love the title. Well, I'd like to begin with a joke from the other side, non-compassion. The story about this rancher who owned thousands of acres. One day he was touring his property, the very edge of the property, which was a dirt road, and it was obvious that there had been a serious accident. There was this large school bus that had crashed into the tree, did not make the turn very well. So he got out, and he noticed that there were a lot of people who had died. And so he buried them. And about 2 days later, the sheriff in the local county was driving through, and he saw the remnants of the bus, and saw some of the earth that had been turned over, obviously. So he eventually found the owner, and he said, looks like there was an accident there. He goes, yep, about 2 days ago. He said, oh, he says, were there any survivors? And he said, well, there were a few that said they were alive, but you know how the politicians, you know, lie, so I buried them all. That's the opposite of compassion. So I'd like to start with a poem by David White entitled The Journey, which kind of points us in the direction of what compassion is about. Above the mountains, the geese turn into the light again, painting their black silhouettes on an open sky. Sometimes everything has to be inscribed across the heavens so you can find the one line already written inside you. Sometimes it takes a great sky to find that first bright and indescribable wedge of freedom in your own heart. Sometimes with the bones of the black sticks left when the fire has gone out, someone has written something new in the ashes of your life. You are not leaving. Even as the light fades quickly now, you are arriving. Compassion reminds us that it's an eternal circle. That is, John Philip Newell points out, rebirthing involves reconnecting. Reconnecting what he's calling compassion. That this is what humanizes us, and I would add, what divinizes us. What helps us to do what Jesus discovered is the fullness of his humanity in the depths of his own human experience. And this is why compassion both excites us, it draws us, and yet it scares us. Because we know intuitively, as David is saying in his poem, that we're going to be changed by it. That we cannot not be changed by the receiving or the letting go of compassion. So I'd like to start with a story. Many years ago, when I was getting ready to celebrate my 30th birthday, I invited my brother John to go backpacking with me through the Hawaiian Islands. We wanted to do it as simple as possible. We had a great, great time. But as fate would have it, if you want to call it that, on my 30th birthday, actually we were on the backside of Maui. And we were way over by the Seven Sacred Pools. We'd hiked through that whole area. And now we're on the edge of that 55-mile Hana Highway, if you've ever heard about that. Okay? And we did have plane reservations back at the airport to fly over to Kauai. And it was at 4 p.m. We thought, no problem. So we were told by the locals how to hitchhike in Hawaii. You're not allowed to stick your thumb out. Just stay on the side of the road and people know what you want. So we did that obediently. Car after car after car passed us. There are all types of cars. Rental cars, brand new cars, trucks even. Everybody passes for the entire day. And I was getting more and more anxious. We're going to miss our flight and all that good stuff. And we couldn't walk 55 miles in one day. And then just about 3 o'clock, this old 55 pickup comes literally rumbling down the road. And in it was what looked like a hippie with his German Shepherd in the front seat. And it looked like the truck was going to fall apart any minute. And that was the only one that stopped. And he said, you guys want to ride? Kind of looked around. I was like, yeah, that'd be great. We got in the truck. I'm not kidding you. From the time we got in, it felt like the whole thing was just going to collapse. But lo and behold, we made it all the way. He didn't ask for money for gas, nothing. He says, good luck. Have a good time. I experienced compassion in such a humbling way. Obviously, one way was I misjudged the man. And it was so touching that God used this stranger, this, in a sense, foreigner to me, to remind me that compassion comes in all shapes and sizes, and that I was the one changed by this experience. How about you? Can you think of a story of compassion in your life that you experienced something happening, changing, deepening, broadening within you? Would you think about that for a moment? Okay, thank you for sharing. Another word that is often used by authors in place of compassion is kindness. Kindness. One of the reasons that compassion hits us so deeply is in a large society, a large city or community, we become more and more one of many faces, many different experiences. And as a result, at some level, we don't expect kindness or compassion. We expect the opposite. So it kind of surprises us. So we have a wonderful example that John Philip Newell uses in the story of Aung San Suu Kyi. And as you know her story, she just by her beingness and by the lessons that she learned from her life, that she embodies compassion. So I like the definition that was put forth. It's being with suffering. But let's take that word and broaden it. Suffering is more than just a physical pain. It's a suffering of being limited. The suffering of recognizing that things don't always go the way we expect or hope or want. That reality often isn't the way we'd hope it would be. That we can't control it. So a way to put it together is to say that to be human is to suffer. To be a creature is to suffer. As we look at this, I like to play with that word and to broaden it a bit when it comes to compassion. Compassion usually moves us into action. It moves us into action because we see someone suffering and we want to help them to be at least alleviated or to remove that suffering from their life. And why one of the most famous universal stories of compassion is the story of the Good Samaritan that crossed religious lines. We recognize this. In fact, we even have in this country what is called Good Samaritan laws. Okay? We recognize also that what compassion does is it opens the possibility of the doors of mutuality. It becomes a starting point. That's all it is. There's no guarantees. Where does it go from there? I never saw that man who gave us that ride again. But as you well know, when you truly have experienced compassion at the hands of someone else, a stranger especially, is that the effects continue to play out in your life, kind of like the effects of a pebble that's been thrown into a still water pond. But compassion is a living force. It's being received as we are, so that life kind of stirs things up for us. We recognize we have no idea who this person was, like in my story, but we recognize the extension of kindness, the hand, or the heart of compassion. We have both an inner and an outer, sometimes reaction or resistance to compassion, because at some level reminds us that we're vulnerable. We're vulnerable. In this situation, we need someone to respond. We need someone to help us. I think I shared with you last time in October, I had just finished a bike ride and a wonderful experience, learned lots of lessons. But the key word for my partner Dick and I in this ride was vulnerability. And what it elicited, not just in us, but in people along the way, was compassion left and right. One of the most touching stories was one day we were just taking a break. Usually about every hour we'd stop and take a 10-minute water break and get off the bike, stretch our legs and whatnot. And we're standing outside this woman's house, and she comes out. She says, "Everything okay?" "Oh, yeah, we're just taking a break." She says, "Well, do you need some more water? Do you want a cup of coffee?" And so we figured, make her feel better. Sure, we could take some extra water. So we walk up, and we just got talking a little bit. And then she disappeared. She came back, and she brought out two plates of freshly made triple deep chocolate cake. We were stunned. It was like, this is a sacrament. This is awesome. It was just such a celebration. And she was smiling from ear to ear, knowing we hadn't had something like that for a couple of weeks. But to recognize that, yes, if you notice, we did have a resistance, even though it was great to have water, we didn't have to look for anybody else. But she was there. She saw the need and responded. As we look to the book, the author points out the threefold path of compassion from the Buddhist perspective. I'd like to use that as an outline for this morning. And as you know in your reading, that it's the courage to see, the courage to feel, and the courage to act. The courage to see reminds us that everything about reality is infinitely precious. Sometimes it takes time and perspective to help us to realize that. Or sometimes in the midst of suffering, we finally begin to get that sense. So, depending upon which tradition you read, we are invited to practice the gift of mindfulness, or presence, or attentiveness to what's going on. In doing that, we begin to be called back to our center. And it's in the center, using the metaphor of the center of the heart, that we find our connection. Would you agree? As you know, the age of rationalism began about 3 centuries ago, and it appears, anthropologically, that we're moving to the end of this age. In other words, the way you can tell is there's a reaction or resistance to the thought life, having always need to figure it out, etc. And it appears we're moving into, I don't know what it's going to be called, but the age of the heart, the wisdom of the heart, listening to the heart rhythms, etc., heart math, and all these different things. So I'd like to ask you to trust this experience. To put you at ease, I was asked by my friend to stand in front of a group of 300 people and do this exercise with him. But it's amazing what comes forth as a way of grounding you in your own heart wisdom, helping you to see with new eyes and to experience compassion at a different level. So I'm going to ask you to stand up and to find a partner. I know there's more women here than men, but find a partner of your own gender if that's possible. If not, find somebody that you can trust. Okay? Okay, so find a same gender partner, and then you're going to stand up. Okay, does everybody have a partner? Now, between the two of you, decide who's going to ask the question and who's going to answer the question. I'm not going to give you the question yet. Okay, somebody needs a partner over here. Okay, you ready? All right, the one asking the question, I want you to place your hand on this person's heart, on their heart, not yours. Put your hand on their heart. Don't take it off. Look them in the eye and ask them this question. What is troubling you right now? What is troubling you right now? Listen to the answer. Speak from your heart. And when you're finished, you can be seated. What was that like for you as somebody was touching your chest, asking you a very personal question? Question of the heart. Did you find it's like almost like truth or consequences? You know, that you're asked to go deeper than just, oh, fine, thank you, everything's okay. And typically that's the rational, that's wanting to cover over. But when you drop down to the level of the heart has its own wisdom, its own truth. That's where compassion comes from. It's a heart wisdom. It's a way of waking us up. So this first level, or Buddhist practice, the courage to see, reminds us, and this is the discipline, is that we must choose to refuse to demonize other people. And no matter how right, how correct you are, but to choose to refuse to demonize other people. Sometimes we admit they're easy targets. Think of some of our political figures. Okay? Very easy targets. But what that does is it takes away the possibility of compassion, you see, from the heart. I'm better than they are because they are just fill in the blank. Okay? Now, another angle would be projecting our stuff onto another person. Choosing to scapegoat others. Now here's one, may surprise you, but also to scape hero other people. Because we are both. Now those of you who come with a Christian background, you know that was the gift, the liberating gift that Jesus came to give us. Is that he would take all this projection, the scapegoating and the scape heroing unto himself, and say, now let's put this aside and just be present to others as sacred beings. So again and again, it's a call to maturity, to see, to feel, and to act as if we are equals. Now, I love this quote in chapter 2, that the greatest obstacle to authentic compassion is the habitual pattern of a narrow self-interest. A narrow self-interest. In other words, what's in it for me? How is this going to affect me? Or even worse, how will this look if I do this? Okay? How will this look if I do this? And this can come out in so many different ways. Who you give money to, the time or the attention you give to another person, how you respond to a question, is to recognize that maybe I need to put myself aside. This is why in the monastic tradition, the great work was the negation of self. Negation of self. Putting one's ego at the door and leaving it there. That there's no place for it here. So, when we speak about the courage to feel, we are to feel with the sufferings of others. Feel with the sufferings of others. And I love that reminder of that great sculpture in the community there in Iona. The Pietà sculpture, where Christ literally is immersed in His mother. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of it or you've had the opportunity to see it in person. Very moving. And those of you who are mothers especially would understand that, you know. And those of you who are fathers in a different way. But you know when you love someone deeply, you literally take their suffering into you. And very often you don't know what to do. But the biblical sense, the gift, the true authentic religious sense, is presence. You just be there with them. I remember a pastor whose wife was in heart, what do you call it, CCU, is it now? Cardiac care unit? Yeah, CCU. And they didn't know if she was going to make it. And because he was a pastor, many of the parishioners came by and they were allowed to come in for maybe a couple minutes. But he says the one person that really helped him the most wasn't the doctor or nurse or any of the specialists. It was a parishioner that he didn't know that well. But he found that later he had suffered a lot. And all this man did is he came in and he stood a little distance behind the pastor. Didn't say a word. Was there for 10 minutes without a word. He just took a couple steps forward and placed his hand on the man's shoulder and just said, "I'm so sorry. I'm so very sorry." And he left. And he said what he did is he honored his suffering. He felt the man's compassion that this man obviously had suffered enough. He knew the best gift was his presence. Have you ever found yourself stuck in one way or another in that you want to do something? You don't know what to do, but anything, just to be able to get out the depth of your feeling, your compassion, your yearning to alleviate the suffering. That is what we would say in intimation, a hint, an invitation of God, that yes, you do need to do something. But the question from this perspective and the courage to feel is, where is it coming from? Is it coming from your need to look good? Your need to be remembered as being helpful? Or is it coming from your authentic, vulnerable place? Recognizing this could be you. This could be you in this spot. So to stand back, to acknowledge, and to truly name what's going on and say, how best can I be present in this person? This man, this parishioner, did it for his pastor because he had done that. In other words, he'd become clear in his intention. Didn't come from a place of ego. Came from an authentic desire of wanting to connect at this level, the courage to feel his own fear and vulnerability, at the same time be present to his pastor's feeling as well. So one way we can do this is to practice authentically listening to the stories of other people. This is why we are so deeply moved by certain scripture stories or certain historical facts or stories of family members or why we're drawn to certain types of humor, etc. But to listen to a story authentically can change the way the story is told and received. Ideally, this is what a well-trained therapist does, is listen to our story. We may think we're a failure, we're stuck, we're conflicted, but he or she can listen and say, what seems to me like I never thought of that. Just by changing and having the courage to see differently, you can experience your life differently. So I want to use an image that helps me when I read the Christian scriptures. What Jesus did for people, in effect, was to invite them to step into a therapeutic circle and to hear and see the story, the experience of her life differently from his experience, from his perspective. So we'd say from God's perspective. And those who trusted him to do that, they were healed. They were healed. There were others who left because they were not willing to do that. They preferred a centrism or a religiosity or certain scriptures or life experience to the offer. To me, that's what real compassion is. So can you enter your own story that way? Or can you do that for a family member, objectively, humbly? Here's things to keep in mind. Alice Miller said in her book, The Body Never Lies, to keep the secret pain of the story locked inside you without adequate expression imprisons you and makes you sick. Imprisons you and makes you sick. So knowing the full story is a predictor of health and happiness, because it's then that as individual human beings we realize we connect to the larger story. And that's what Sui Ki is doing for her people. She's reminding them, it's not just about me. You know, this truth that I'm living will live long after I'm dead. This is why compassion touches us uniquely according to the context of our lives. So let's suppose you have been a victim of a crime, or you've been betrayed deeply and painfully. Perhaps you can change the way you look at what happened to you by being reminded that victimization is an event. It actually happened. But you have a choice in how to respond. Being a victim is a choice. Telling the story differently is how you get your dignity back. It's how you get your dignity back. To recognize that this is exactly what the whole Paschal mystery is about. Why the church honors the different stages of development and execution, the reality, the life of Christ. To remind us that we too as human beings must know when and where to celebrate reality as it is, when we need to let go of our attachment to a relationship or a situation, to health, whatever it may be, so that we can receive something new, always different. And then we have to let the old ascend and bless us, that we can receive the new spirit for our life now. There it is. That's the summary of the Christian myth. Putting that in perspective takes work, though. It means we have to go back again and again and again and say, how do I tell my story? You know? Those of you who are married, think about how you tell the story of when you first met each other. Or what it's like now to be married after a few decades. I'm sure you talk about your wedding day differently today than you did 3 months after you were married. And you recognize that so many things that were important to you 25 years ago, nothing now. You find that you hold on to different things as a way of telling your story, depending upon your audience and your continuing life experience. As we read the Christian scriptures, we see that Jesus was moved to the bowels of compassion, the depth of compassion, is instinctual, that this is what moved him to do what he did. That seed of compassion is within you because you too share in that divine nature. You too share in its ingodness in such a way that there will be certain types of human suffering or suffering of animals or suffering of the planet that will move you. Be an invitation for you to truly pass on what it is that you truly yearn to give this human community, this planet, at this time in history. But again, we come back to the heart. The courage to feel is meant to be an invitation to feel deeply, not just to touch it, but to help you to move through it almost to step into and through the mystery, to experience your own vulnerability, your own humanity and its unique nature. So you remember the story of Dr. Newell's lifetime practice of blessing his son, and how when he began to lose his memory, the family decided it was necessary for them to sell the car. And it was a very touchy thing, so they turned to John Philip to handle it. And he did it in a brilliant way. He called the salesman ahead of time and explained the situation and walked him through it. And it was just a very touching father-son moment. But what really moved me was a blessing. When at the very end of the transaction, if you remember, he turned to the salesman and says, "Now my father has this practice." And the salesman knew him by reputation. He said he likes to bless people whenever he leaves them. "Would that be okay with you?" The salesman said, "Sure." So here is this younger salesman coming forward, and Dr. Newell places his hand on his shoulder and looks at him and gives him the blessing from Numbers 6, 24 to 25. And the young man starts to cry. He is so moved by it that the compassion of this man, who's a stranger to him, would speak these words that are so traditional back in the Hebrew tradition, that now, after all these centuries, it's become real to this man, that it moved him. So one of the things we're learning about stress and disconnection from our heart, from our center, from our compassion, is that we do have ways that are embedded within our humanity that can bring us back to our authentic nature. And one of them is the breath, the way we breathe. I understand that most of us, myself included, we only use about one-third of our lungs in the normal breathing throughout the day. So yogic practitioners teach us that we need to be able to involve the whole aspect of our breathing mechanism, the whole apparatus, to not only get the benefits of exercise and movement, but the benefits that can begin to quiet the heart. So if you're interested in doing some further research on this, I refer you to a book called Transforming Stress by Childray and Rossman. And in this research, I know at first you think this is way too simple. The research has pointed out that when you practice breathing in to a six count, holding it, and then breathing out to a six count, you will find your whole body quieting down, and it quiets your mind down. So that if you're prone to anxiety, or you're prone to fear, or you're prone to any sense that would pull you off that center of knowing, being your best self, come back to the breath. Come back to the breath. So I'd like to practice that with you. Is that okay? So you just sit up in your chair. Close your eyes so you're not distracted. And I just began to take a breath, a deep breath in, to a six count. So that by the time you get to six, you've already got as much oxygen as you can bring in. Hold it. Then when you're ready, let out the breath again to a six count. And with that discipline, just continuing to breathe for the next couple of minutes. Just focus on counting in six, out six, holding on to the breath as long as you want. As long as you notice the level of comfort within your body is recognizable. Okay, when you're ready, you can open your eyes. From inside your body, how do you feel? Oxygenated, yes.
Relaxed.
Mm-hmm. Centered. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another author by the name of John Coles, he's a psychotherapist, said the first time he read this book, he threw it away. He said, "This is nonsense." And that in a time of his life where he's highly stressed, he decided, what the heck, I'll practice it. He found that it took him 2 months of disciplined breathing for just 5 to 10 minutes a day that it began to change his whole life. His issue in his life, as he admitted, is anxiety. And that by coming back to the breath again and again, his anxiety left him. And many of the things that he's afraid of in life, he began to consciously confront them with the breath and they disappeared. So it changed not only his personal life, but the way he worked with many of his clients. Because, see, the breathing brings us back to the fact that we are a creature. our thoughts take us away from that. You know, that we move out of our bodies. We disconnect from the wisdom of the heart. Transforming Stress is by Childre, Childre, and Rossman, Rozman. You can read it for yourself. So their research points out that what the breathing does, it helps you to come back to your center, and that which you're most afraid of or any negative emotion begins to dissipate much more quickly. Think of it as almost like an armor built inside your body. So a mature person is able to hold grief and gratitude in a paradoxical tension. By doing this, it leads to deep compassion and connection. Notice it doesn't negate one or the other. It doesn't negate the fact that I'd like to connect with you, or that my heart's being ripped out by this death experience or this damaging accident or whatever. But to hold it in tension, it creates something new. And the children of this connection is compassion, deep intimacy, connection. So I want to give you an example of this. The story about this fireman. He had been called to a building that was on fire. It was a three-story building, apartment building, as a matter of fact. And in the ensuing work, he had to rescue an older woman from the second story. So he got up the ladder, climbed in the window, carried her out on his shoulder, and came back down. Okay. Well, about 2-3 days later, he was traveling off-duty in his truck, and he came to an intersection where there had just been a traffic accident. Is that this truck had T-boned an SUV, knocked the SUV on its side. And as he drove up, he noticed that there was fuel coming out of the SUV, and the engine was still going. So he quickly got out of his truck, ran over, and noticed that the driver was unconscious. But what struck him was there was, at the passenger side, was the car carrier for an infant. And the infant had been decapitated. Yeah, it's a true story. So what he did is he reached in and turned the engine off and took the keys out and walked away and called professionals to come and take care of the accident. So about 2 weeks after that, he began to notice that his shoulder had frozen up. He couldn't move it. And so he applied for disability and just assumed it was from carrying the woman out from the fire. To make a long story short, he went to go see a psychiatrist. And as he met with him, he said, well, tell me what happened. He told him the story of carrying the woman out of the house. He said, well, okay. He said, that makes sense. But he said, you know, you also experienced something else around there, I understand. He goes, yeah. He said, tell me about the story about the accident. And so the fireman did. And psychiatrist said, okay. He says, I'm going to invite you to do something. He said, why don't you close your eyes and get really connected, really grounded in that experience, and picture yourself going through the experience one more time. And so the psychiatrist talked him through it, but at the time he was getting ready to turn off the engine, he said, I want you to look at the baby. Make sure you look at the head. See the whole picture. And then when you're ready, reach across, hurry, reach across, you can smell the fumes, turn off the engine. Step away. Now back up. He said, okay, would you please stand up? And so the man stood up. He says, now I'd like you to see if you can move your arm a bit. Can you do this? He said, yeah. How about this? Yeah. Okay. Can you do that? Yeah. Try and reach the ceiling. He said, wow. What happened? Is there any way your shoulder will not move? He said, no. Fine. What'd you do? He said, you were disconnected from the message of your body. What I didn't tell you was, he had a child the same age as that infant. He became disconnected from his story. You see? He was acting strictly in the role of professional fireman. You do the job. You do the best you can with what's happening in the situation. He disconnected from his fatherly instinct to weep, to grieve, to want to do something in regards to the baby. We have the same possibility and principle inside us. And the busier our lives are, the more we race through and we disconnect from all the other possibilities of feeling. And so sometimes, not all the time, sometimes when we do that, finally the heart says, that's enough. That's enough. So we're going to stop you by waking you up, by reconnecting you with your body. So the breath is one way to bring you back to center. To sit with that. Activity is another way, yes. So let's move on to the courage to act. The courage to act. We learn from the story of the Good Samaritan that love is an action. It's not just a mind state. And so is compassion. How often we may have found ourselves saying, oh, isn't that sad? Too bad. Too bad somebody wasn't there to help. Or too bad such and such. It's more than that. It's an invitation to interact. I know one author who says that God uses the gift of the poor to wake us up to our own powerlessness, our own inner poverty. There was a priest on the east coast of this country who took a sabbatical, a very, very interesting sabbatical. What he did was he traveled around homeless shelters. He dressed incognito, meaning he dressed like a homeless man. But he would find the director of the center and tell him what he was doing. He said, I'm a priest in sabbatical. I just want to be as innocuous as I can, but at the same time, I'd like to talk to the homeless. And they all let him do it. So for 6 months, he lived the life of a homeless man. And he decided to write a book on it. I'm sorry, I don't know the title. But what he wrote about was fascinating. If you could summarize his experiences, it came down to this. Several of the homeless people said to him, would you tell people that the main thing we want to do is to be treated like a human being? Talk to us. Look us in the eye. If you can't give us money, that's fine. We understand. But that was the general tenor of what he heard for 6 months. Now, obviously, there's many exceptions to that, obviously. But here's a story from one of my former bosses, Sister Edith. She, in her community, they are trained to carry a bit of money, purposely to give to the homeless. And she had just come out of a pharmacy, and there's a homeless man there. And he greeted her and asked how she's doing, and she reached in her purse and gave him a few bucks. And then he said, well, thank you, but he said, would you talk to me? So she smiled, and she listened to the story. And at the end of his story, he said, thank you for listening to me. He said, that's more precious than money. He said, may I give you a blessing? Sister Edith was really touched. She says, I'm so used to blessing everybody else. And she says, yes, you can give me a blessing. He put his hand on her shoulder, and he said, gave a wonderful blessing. So there's that wonderful back and forthness that even human beings have been ostracized, alienated, marginalized, strange in a foreign land, etc., invite us to see that we are to practice profound simplicity, which means getting back to the basics. That yes, it's easy for us to reach in our purse or our pocket and give a few bucks. It's a lot easier than sitting and saying, how long is it going to take? You're going to talk to me about your story? You know, I'm not in a place to hear the story because, I'm really up to here with too much compassion. I've got compassion fatigue. And a lot of us don't want to go there. And yet, here it's someone, a situation, it's calling forth, inviting us to once again step down into the wisdom of the heart. So, where do we begin? How do you know that it's God who's prompting you to do something? To do something. Well, I like that quote that Sue talked about. Those who are doing nothing to improve the world have no hope for it. Have no hope for it. As we read the scriptures and humbly think about our lives, faith plus hope plus action equal change. Faith plus hope plus action equal change. It works together. There is a direct relationship between hope and action. To some other, when you do this action, you are hoping that it might help this person. Or maybe it might redound and have other effects in other people's lives. The word may get out. But the other quote that I found very helpful was Vaclav Havel, who said, I stop waiting for the world to improve and exercise my right to intervene in that world. Okay? Notice he's speaking about moving from being childish to being an adult in this world. Being childish means, I hope it changes, I hope it changes, I hope it changes, I hope it changes. Or the religious leaders need to change it, or the political leaders, or my mother and father, the pastor, whoever. But to finally realize that you're an adult, you have a natural inborn intelligence, you have a life story, you have a history. How is God inviting you to take a step forward in faith and hope and moving you to an action that can bring about change? Each of us is essential in this wonderful picture, this wonderful puzzle of living out and sharing compassion. Because eyes are watching us. One of the things that no matter how much we can pick on or make fun of the next generation or two generations back is that, oh, they're not going to church, not doing this, they're narcissistic, all the things we've heard, is do you know that the vast majority of them in their spirituality, they all have an active component. Because they see for them that that's necessary, putting their spirituality in practice. And invariably, it's not ecclesial. It's not what we call connected with the church. They're looking into new ways of helping people to raise them up economically or educationally, etc. But I found this to be very humbling. In my generation, we weren't really taught that. We just talked about charity. We weren't talked about justice or building for the future, etc. So it behooves us to recognize there is different ways of reaching out and sharing that compassion. All are welcome. All are welcome. I'm sure you've heard of the Dalai Lama's famous quote when it said, could you summarize what your religion is? And he said, it's compassion. It's kindness. You know? So loving kindness is an active Buddhist practice where you close your eyes and you just picture yourself extending loving kindness out to a specific person or situation. You say, well, that's pretty easy. No, it's not. It's hard. Especially if you don't like that person. Or if they don't deserve it, you know. Or they don't, quote, belong to you and your tribe, you know. It really is a discipline to practice, okay, today I'm going to do that. So, true confession, it's been very, very hard for me to do that for President Trump. It has been extremely hard. And I share this very confidentially with you, even though I know it's going to be broadcast. But this is from my heart. I never thought I had an enemy in the world until Trump was elected. And my reaction really taught me I have an enemy. And that's a gift. I can say that now. Because God has shown me that, for me, He embodies everything I don't stand for. And it's been a real struggle for me. So what I've begun to do is to listen to how the Spirit would invite me to change that real enemy relationship to one of real compassion. So from a Catholic perspective, as you know, from the time we're small, we're taught how to pray the rosary. And this is something that I learned many years ago, and I often would give it in the sacrament of penance. So now it's my own penance. And it's taking the Hail Mary and changing it. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for Donald, now and at the hour of his death. Amen. And I promise you, by the time I get to the 10th Hail Mary, my feelings have come back to center. The other thing is to practice what I just taught you, the breathing. Okay? Nothing changes unless something changes. And I come at this from a place of faith and hope. It's something very simple. But it's slowly melting my own heart in a time of great, great challenge. And it's not just him personally. It's what he represents. You know that. Okay? And I find that it's God's way of saying, okay, it's time for you to put up or shut up. Are you a man of faith and hope? If so, come on, show me an action. What's that mean? It's beginning to make simple choices that are profound, that are deep, that begin to move you into another type of action. Then this is where the whole idea of nonviolent action comes from. Okay? What is it that really moves you? And how will it move you into nonviolent action? Maybe it may invite you to take another way of how you drive. Take another look at it. Do you notice that your type of driving is aggressive? You know, as you notice, whenever we scapegoat or scape hero a public figure, what's happening in our country right now is what happens. It gives credence to people who are of no importance. Say, well, he's doing it. She's doing it. What about me? I can do it. You know, and it's one of those things where Change happens by the first little steps. How do we do this? How do we move forward? Better question is, what am I called to do? What can I do? The wisdom of the little ones in the scriptures are the things that can help. And invariably, it's a deep invitation to come back to the wisdom of the heart, compassion. So I leave you with this final reminder before the break, and that is this. Have you ever noticed that God used the different, the foreigner, the Gentile, to change Jesus' way of seeing and feeling and moving him to different action? The four times that he encounters Gentiles, his comments to them let you know he was trapped in his own tribal sense, his own Jewish mindset. And yet, because of the encounter, he ends up saying to them, "Never have I seen this much faith in all of Israel." Is it possible in this very confusing time that that's what God is doing? God is inviting us to truly see, feel, and act from a different place. And the people and situations that are doing this are people and situations we would never invite into our home. We would never make friends with. It's that important that God is using reality to wake us all up, to bring us back to our deep religious sense on the inside, to recognize that none of us is innocent, that we all have to face this time together in our own way, humbly, compassionately, and faithfully. Have a good break. I got some plans for you after the break. Okay.